Don't be afraid of the dark. Just relax and let the darkness fall over you.
Welcome to Afraidish, a podcast where each month / every four episodes, we venture into a new state and take a deep dive into the paranormal and unexplained while enjoying some tasty adult beverages. From ghost sightings to hauntings, urban legends and cryptids, let's get weird and afraid-ish together. Hello and welcome to Afraidish. I'm Paul.
And I'm Ashley.
This is episode 8.
Woo-hoo! Little
yay.
Crazy 8.
So, hey, Ashley.
Hey, what?
Do you like shoes?
What do you think?
Yes, you do. Do you like handbags?
Yeah.
How about a nice rug or even furniture covers?
Okay.
Well, look no further. This episode is sponsored by ST's Tannery and Tannery Accessories. He has men's and women's leather shoes and even cowboy boots all sizes. ST's is one of the top sellers of women's handbags and, for you guys, man bags and laptop bags. Maybe wrap yourself in some leather. Maybe a leather jacket to go with your new scooter. He has domestic...
Does it come with matching gloves?
Yes, it does. He has domestic and exotic skins of all colors. The exotic specimens do cost a bit extra. T is one of America's most efficient and precise skinners and tanners. His precise attention to detail certainly doesn't go unnoticed either. Do you want freckles on your new detailed shoes? How about adding some accessories like a tooth necklace or even leather toe socks? He uses the same hunting knife he kills his victims. Specimens with. If this deal sounds amazing to you, visit any location near you. Come see Skinned Tom at ST's Tannery and Tannery Accessories, located at 666 South Lover's Lane in all 50 states. But please beware, if you visit these locations, you might not come out. Anyway, for free shipping on all orders, visit Skinned Tom at whatthefuckiswrongwithme.com.
What the fuck is wrong with you? Did you write that?
I did.
Oh my god.
So, episode 8 is sponsored by Skin Tom at ST's Tannery and Tannery Accessories.
Are you Skin Tom?
No.
Do I need to worry? Are you going to harvest me and sell me off for a handbag?
No. Every time we do an episode, Hershey needs to chew on a bone.
He's a dog. What do you expect?
But it seems like he waits until we record.
He chews on his bone all day long, sir.
Anyways. Back to the episode.
Welcome to, apparently, my own personal hell.
I hope I got somebody. But with you laughing through the whole thing, it didn't...
I'm sorry.
Didn't get quite the, you probably won't get the attention anyways. All right, and I am going to try a beer called Mexican Villa Cerveza Flying Ace Lager from Piney River Brewing Company in Bucyrus, Missouri.
Bucyrus. Is it Bucyrus or is it Bucyrus?
I don't know. Either way. It's in Missouri. Let's try this. It's not bad. I mean, it tastes like a lager.
Yeah. It doesn't really taste like any... Like, that's what I would call a small beer.
Yeah.
Like, in medieval terms. We drink that because we can't drink water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway.
That's not very hoppy at all.
No. Probably like the restaurant Mexican Villa in Springfield.
You're gonna alienate like 90% of your listenership.
Don't sue me. Anyway, here are 5 more fun facts about Tennessee. Number 1, the cotton candy machine was invented by a dentist from Nashville. perhaps trying to generate more cavities to fill, dentist William Morrison and candy maker John C. Wharton co-created the cotton candy machine in 1897. They debuted their device at the 1904 St. Louis World's Fair, where it was an immediate hit. They sold 68,655 boxes for 25 cents each. Now, in today's money, well, back then it was they made over $17,000. In today's money, that's just over $500,000.
Wow.
Yeah. Number two, creator of the world famous Tennessee whiskey, Jack Daniels died after angrily kicking a safe and hurting his toe, leading to the blood infection that would be his demise.
What? So, I didn't know that's how he died.
Yeah, Jack Daniels died from
blood kicking infection. A safe.
Yeah.
Wow. Get your anger issues under control, people. Might kill you someday.
Yeah. Number three. It is illegal to catch a fish in Tennessee with a lasso.
Why, though? I want to know the story behind that law.
Now, these laws, like, in every state...
Hershey!
Chill, dude. Like, these laws have got to be put in place due to some morons doing these ridiculous things.
Like, who got drunk, went down to the river, and decided to have a lassoing contest with his buddy?
You know, I don't think that should be illegal, because if you can catch a fish with a lasso, that's an impressive feat.
Yeah, that should be encouraged. Well, okay, maybe not encouraged.
Get you a beer, go get drunk, and go lasso
some
fish.
Please don't do that, you'll drown.
Yeah.
That's probably what happened.
That's probably what happened, yeah. Number four. Mountain Dew was invented in Tennessee by brothers Allie and Barney Hartman as a mixer to cut the strong and unpleasant taste of their homemade moonshine.
Oh, of course Mountain Dew was invented by Mountain Dew.
In 1964, Pepsi bought the Hartman Brothers Lemon Lime concoction. So, yeah, Mountain Dew has been owned by Pepsi since 1964.
Wow.
And number five. In 1916, Piggly Wiggly was conceived in Memphis. It would be the first self-service grocery store. Before that, you would have to give your...
Yes, you would go to the grocers, give them the list and sit and wait while they did the... Which, the Victorians ruined a lot of things, but they did not ruin grocery shopping. In fact, I think grocery shopping has only gone downhill since that period.
Well, only because you have to deal with other customers and...
You have to do all the work yourself. Like I said, you would go down to the grocer, hand him your list, sit in a chair while he did the shopping for you, and then they would even deliver it sometimes, most of the time, to you.
In a horse and buggy, they would have a delivery guy. Yep. Anyway, my story is called... Union Station Hotel.
Okay.
All right. I was just waiting for you.
Okay. Your story, your location is called Union Station Hotel.
Yes. Resembling a modern-day castle, the Union Station Hotel began construction on August 1st, 1898 as a train station. On October 9th, 1900, the Union Station Nashville Yards opened to the public for the Louisville and Nashville Railroad. This amazingly beautiful Gothic-style train terminal has some unique and special characteristics, such as a heavy stone Richardsonian Romanesque design, a 65-foot barrel-vaulted lobby ceiling featuring gold-leaf medallions and a 100-year-old original luminous prism-stained glass.
Wow.
It has marble floors, oak-accented doors and walls, and three limestone fireplaces. 20 gold-accented base... Oh. It's pronounced... Okay, it's spelled B-A-S hyphen relief, but it's pronounced bas-relief.
Yeah, it's French.
Yeah. 20 gold-accented bas-relief angel of commerce figurines. two bas-relief panels, a steam locomotive, and a horse-drawn chariot at each end of the lobby.
What?
Yeah. What?
I'm looking at pictures. Okay.
Artists create a bas-relief by sculpting onto a... Okay, this is what a bas-relief is. Artists create a bas-relief by sculpting onto a 2D plane to create and accentuate figures and objects, producing a 3D appearance that can be viewed from all angles with little distortion, which is pretty damn cool.
Yeah.
Okay, get this. The track level once held two alligator ponds.
Why?
I have no idea. I mean, they're not there anymore, but...
Right.
It's funny. The train shed was the largest unsupported span in America, housing up to 10 full trains at once.
Unsupported?
Unsupported span in America. That's what the article says.
Right.
Union Station was designed by one of the most famous American architects, Henry Hobson Richardson. Henry Hobson Richardson, who along with Louis Sullivan and Frank Lloyd Wright, was one of the, quote, recognized trinity of American architecture. Uh-huh. Richardson designed 9 railroad stations for the Boston and Albany Railroad, as well as 3 stations for other lines. The station reached peak usage during World War II, when it was the shipping out point for tens of thousands of U.S. troops. After the war, it started a long decline as passenger rail service in the U.S. generally was reduced. Mm-hmm. By the 1960s, it was served by only a few trains daily. Much of its open spaces were roped off, and its architectural features became largely the habitat of pigeons. Yeah. The formation of Amtrak in 1971 reduced service to the northbound and southbound Floridian train each day. In 1977, the Union Station was designated a National Historic Landmark. In October 1979, all services were discontinued and the station was abandoned entirely. Mm. The station fell into the custody of the United States Government's General Services Administration. It became vacant until 1986. In the early 1980s, a group of investors came forward with a plan to finance the station's renovation into a luxury hotel that was approved. After extensive renovations, the new investor group who bought the hotel out of bankruptcy was able to operate it profitably. Yeah, profitably. Since the site was converted into a hotel in 1986, there have been many renovations. The first would occur in 2007 and would cost around $11 million. Yeah. In 2012, Marriott purchased the hotel and another $1.9 million was used to upgrade the hotel. Yeah. In 2014, Pebble Rock purchased the station for over $50 million. They had spent just over $15 million on renovations at that time.
Wow.
Today, much of the history remains. You can walk into the doors and still see several things from the past. You can still see the heavy stone design, gold leaf medallions, stained glass that is over 100 years old, and much more. The hotel still has limestone fireplaces, marble floors, and a lot of the original oak-accented items.
Wow.
The hotel is no longer a place for just...
Damn it.
It's just a reoccurring thing now. More stuff playing in the background. Anyways.
The podcast is haunted.
It's haunted. Hershey's haunted.
By fleas.
By fleas. Shit. Anyway, the hotel is no longer a place for just passing through. It is a destination that many people want to end up. It has modern touches with old nostalgic history. The hotel has 125 guest rooms. Each room is decorated uniquely. There is a restaurant and a bar on site.
So it's a boutique, expensive hotel.
Yes. And now for the haunting. As with any folktale, there are some natural variations. Mm-hmm. But there is one version that stuck, which is arguably the most tragic of all. During World War II, 20-year-old Abigail said goodbye to her beau at Union Station before he left for France. While standing on the platform, she promised she would be waiting for him in the same spot when the war was over. After the war, she returned to the station only to find out that he had been killed while in Europe. Abigail was so heartbroken that she threw herself in front of a moving train. In an article written by Todd Atterbury, titled Haunted Hotels in Nashville, Tennessee, Union Station Hotel, the author dives even deeper into the ghost story. A woman having a smoke out on the hotel's old platform witnessed a woman dressed in vintage clothing. Without taking her eyes off the mysterious woman, she continues to smoke. The woman disappeared for a few seconds, only to reappear, hop over the rail, and drop onto the tracks, which were several feet below. The woman is hysterical, thinking she just witnessed someone jump to their death, but when she looked over, there was no one. All she saw down on the tracks was a man in uniform, waiting for someone. It is said that the man is the ghost of the U.S. soldier who returned to the terminal to find Abigail. The spirit of Abigail and the soldier are believed to be stuck on a loop. She jumps to her death, and he arrives only seconds after, but they always miss each other. Abigail's story has been used to justify the strange noises and eerie feelings guests experience while staying in room 711. However, it would seem that, at least in this room, we are dealing with a completely different ghost. Guests staying in room 711 claim they have heard strange noises such as phone ringing, lights flickering, and stomping on the roof, as if someone is walking on the top floor. The catch is, room 711 is on the top floor. It was once the building's attic, but it was transformed into additional rooms when the hotel was being built. People also describe hearing what sounds like heavy furniture dragged above the room, especially during the early hours of the morning. Some have even felt sudden unexplained drops in the room's temperature and feeling like they are not alone. Both are common occurrences in a haunted location. It's hard to say who is haunting this specific room and why. Is it Abigail or someone else? If it is her, why this room? There are plenty of unanswered questions. We know for sure that there is definitely something going on in this room, and that is likely explained by the century-old building's past. If you stayed in room 711, would it make you afraid-ish?
Depends.
I would stay there. Be fun.
I might not want to sleep there, but...
I would sleep there.
It depends on the ghost.
Yeah.
All right. So is that your story?
Yeah.
All right. Short and sweet.
Yeah.
Now, listeners, my story is the opposite. Oh, I am drinking a white wine spritzer cocktail. I don't know. I found this wine at Aldi. It was $3.99 for the bottle, and it is pineapple, sweet pineapple. It's extremely sweet. And then I've gone ahead and added about a shot of coconut rum and homemade strawberry simple syrup and seltzer water, which the seltzer water really didn't do anything. But, I mean, it's super sweet. But it's tasty.
That's cool.
All right. So my story was suggested by my very handsome co-host. And it is the Ryman Auditorium.
Yes.
Now this story is hella long. I'm hoping it's not a repeat of the penitentiary from episode 5. The first one in Tennessee?
Yeah, that was a pretty long episode.
It's pretty long. It's I kept thinking, all right, we're getting to the end of the history. And then it just kept going and going.
It's got a lot of history.
It's got a lot of history. So, the Ryman Auditorium was built in 1885, between 1885 and 1892. It was the passion project of Thomas Ryman, a reformed sinner. Thomas Ryman had made his fortune in riverboats and saloons. And in 1885, he attended a tent revival led by the renowned revivalist Samuel Porter Jones. And while Thomas had originally attended with the intention of heckling and booing the preacher, he ended up feeling the spirit move within him or whatever, and converted, becoming a very devout Christian. He immediately set to work on planning and constructing a tabernacle because he wanted the Reverend Samuel Porter Jones to move his revivals out of the tent and into a proper building.
Yep.
He christened the church the Union Gospel Tabernacle. His intention was for the tabernacle. His intention was for the tabernacle to become the home of Reverend Jones. The building was designed by architect Hugh. I cannot read my own handwriting. Mm-hmm. Hugh Cathcart Thompson, and it took 7 years to complete. It cost around $100,000. Which would be about $2,880,370 in 2020's money. It ended up going $20,000 over budget, around $576,074 in today's money, when it finally opened in 1892. Yes. Reverend Jones suggested that they name the auditorium in Ryman's honor, which Thomas refused and went with the Union Gospel Tabernacle. Always had a hard time with the word tabernacle.
Yeah.
When the tabernacle opened in 1895, it was missing the balcony because they didn't have enough funds to cover the cost because it had gone $20,000 over budget.
Yeah.
But just 2 years later, in 1897, the United Confederate Veterans Association put up the money to add the balcony in time for them to host an event, a ceremony of some kind there. So they, because of the generous donation, they named the balcony the Confederate Gallery. Cozy. In 1901, a stage was added, reducing the seating from about 4,000 to, I think it said, 1,000, which seems like a lot for a stage. Like,
yeah. Huh.
Thomas Ryman died in 1904. His memorial service was held at the tabernacle, obviously, and Reverend Jones proposed renaming the building to the Ryman Auditorium, which received there was no resistance to that idea. The good old Reverend died in 1906. Now, although the auditorium was intended to serve as a house of worship, because of its debt, it was frequently leased to performers, non-religious events such as plays, lectures, things like that. Lula C. Neff was a widow and mother who was working as a court stenographer to support her family. She began booking and promoting events in her spare time. She booked anything from speaking engagements to boxing matches, and concerts and plays. When her employer closed in 1914, she began to devote all of her time into organizing events full-time. By 1920, she took on a post as the official manager for the Ryman Auditorium. She changed her name, or at least and when doing business, went by the name of L.C. Naff to avoid preconceived notions about being a female. A working woman. Scandalous. Naff was a bit of a babe, I'm not going to lie. I kind of developed a little bit of a crush on her when researching this.
Nice.
She became notorious for going up against local censorship groups seeking to ban certain, quote, inappropriate performances. In 1939, she won a lawsuit against a local group called the Nashville Board of Censors. Bunch of peaches, I bet, you know. Yeah. Bless their hearts. They wanted to have the star of the play, Tobacco Road, arrested because the play was too, quote, provocative. I mean, the court declared the law allowing the creation of censors to be invalid. Side note, I Googled the Nashville Board of Censors. Thank you, Google. I searched the Nashville Board of Censors on a very popular search engine that you've heard of. And the chair of the board, named Henry Hamilton Love, or Hamilton Love, looked exactly how you would think the chairman of a board of censors would look. Yeah. I mean, he looked like he would be right at home with at a Klan rally or at a ritual at...
basically a middle-aged white guy.
No. Young. He looked like he would be right at home at Wewelsburg Castle, which was Heinrich Himmler's occult lair.
Gotcha.
You know? Very haunting looking man. Just not good vibes. About your age-ish, maybe? I don't know. Anyway, back to Naff. She was the reason that the Ryman was as popular of a venue as it was. She was an expert at her craft. She managed to book the most popular, world-renowned entertainers, stage shows. Just a few of the names that she was able to have come into the Ryman was Will Rogers, Charlie Chaplin, Bob Hope, Doris Day.
Charlie Chaplin.
Charlie, did I not say Charlie Chaplin?
You said Chaplin.
What did well, the vino and rum is kicking in. Charlie Chaplin, Bob Hope, Doris Day, and Harry Houdini, just to name a few. I mean, the list goes on. The Ryman earned the nickname the Carnegie Hall of the South, and I think that Lula had a lot to do with that. The very first event to sell out at the Ryman was a lecture by Kellen Heller and Anne's Kellen Heller.
Are you drunk yet?
Maybe. Helen Keller and her lifelong companion, Anne Sullivan Macy.
That's awesome.
L.C. Naff was a feminist icon. As well as being a champion of diversity, she frequently booked the Fisk Jubilee Singers, which was an African-American a cappella group from Fisk University, which was a predominantly African university, although nice. They did have a few other ethnicities in attendance, mostly not white, though. Naff retired in 1955 and sadly died in 1960. In 1925, the Grand Ole Opry debuted as a radio show. It was originally called the WSM Barn Dance and aired over AM radio in 30 states throughout the eastern portion of the country. It wasn't originally intended as a stage show, but fans began visiting the studio at the radio station to watch it performed live.
That's awesome.
When the crowds got too big for the radio studio, WSM Radio began to broadcast from theaters. They started at the Hillsborough Theater, then they moved to the, the Dive Tavern. That's not right. The Dixie Tabernacle. then the War Memorial Auditorium. After 4 years at the War Memorial Auditorium, rowdy crowds and damaged upholstery caused the Opry to be kicked out. Elsie Knapp and the others at the Ryman thought that the auditorium would make the perfect venue to host the Opry because of the wooden pews instead of upholstered seating. No damage can be done to wooden pews, I guess. I don't know. I mean, it's not true, but not as easily as upholstery, I guess.
Yeah.
On June 5th, 1943, the Opry broadcasted its first show at the Ryman Auditorium, beginning a 31-year institution. Prior to 1963, the auditorium was governed by a board of directors. It had no individual owner until WSM purchased the building for $207,500, roughly $1,754,052 in 2020 money. They renamed it the Grand Ole Opry House. And although, you know, it had been known as the Ryman Auditorium for 60 plus years, people still called it the Ryman Auditorium, just like here people still call Mercy Hospital St. John's,
yeah,
etc. I mean, shit, people still call Price Cutter Ramey's.
Yeah.
Anywho, the WSM paid for minor upgrades to the building in 1966 just to maintain its functionality. Then in 1969, they announced plans to move the show to a brand new venue built specifically for the Opry. WSM had purchased a large parcel of land out to the east at the time where it was pretty rural and planned to build an amusement park, and a brand new auditorium would be the centerpiece of this amusement park called Opryland USA.
Nice.
Part of the reason for the proposed move was because the Ryman was starting to become dilapidated. It didn't have any kind of air conditioning or heating, so it was pretty miserable. There's only one dressing room, which usually the men got, leaving the women to have to get ready in a very inadequate bathroom. Performers would often loiter in the halls and even in the alleys, which eventually they started kind of exploring the alleyways and hitting all the little local honky-tonk dive bars, which kind of boosted their popularity because all these famous performers would be at these bars, and sometimes they'd have impromptu performances there while they're waiting to perform at the Opry.
Yeah.
So it was really a good boost for the local, the very local economy around the Ryman. But they wanted to kind of clean up the image a little bit, keep the performers out of the alleyways from drinking, getting in trouble. And instead of improving the existing building, they thought it would just be better to build a brand new building on an amusement park. The new facility would also bear the moniker of the Grand Ole Opry House. And like I said, it was built as the centerpiece of the Opryland USA compound. The park, Opryland USA, opened in 1972, and the new Grand Ole Opry House opened in March of 1974. The final shows at the Ryman were very emotional for the performers, for the audience, for everybody. Sarah Cannon, performing as Minnie Pearl, broke down in tears on stage. They had a circle cut out of the stage at the Ryman and inlaid it into the new stage at the Grand Ole Opry House. Ryman dropped the name Grand Ole Opry House and went back to using the Ryman Auditorium to avoid confusion. When WSM originally announced its plans to build the new venue, they had also planned on demolishing the Ryman and using the salvageable materials in a chapel that they wanted to call the Little Church of Opryland. The WSM president, Irving Dude, some of these names. W-A-U-G-H. Wag? Wag? I don't even know. Anyway, Irving hired a consultant named, oh my god, I can't read my fucking handwriting. Jesus Christ. Joe Melziner. He actually, side note, had produced, been involved in production at the Ryman in 1935. He said that the Ryman was, quote, full of bad workmanship and contains nothing of value as a theater worth restoring. Pushing for the building to be razed and replaced with a modern theater.
What a dick.
Yeah. Obviously, the public did not take too kindly to these plans, and they were met with a lot of pushback from local citizens as well as musicians. Pulitzer Prize winner Ada Louise Huxtable wrote in the New York Times, first prize for the pious misuse of a landmark and a total misunderstanding of the principles of preservation. Gentlemen, for shame. However, one of the larger stakeholders in Opryland, USA, Roy Acuff, was purported to say that I never want another note of music played in that building. And he was pretty much at the forefront of the whole demolish the Ryman movement.
Fucking patriarchy.
For fuck's sake, man. Members of several historic preservation groups argued that WSM and Acuff, as well as other shareholders and executives at Opryland USA, exaggerated the poor condition of the Ryman because they were afraid that the general love for the Ryman, the nostalgia of the building itself, would negatively impact Opryland USA's bottom line.
Yep.
So, whatever. The Ryman Auditorium was added to the National Register of Historic Places in 1971. Two U.S. Senators, Howard Baker and Bill Brock, as well as the U.S. Department of Interior, pleaded with WSM and executives to preserve the Ryman. They decided not to demolish it, but they also didn't do shit as far as, like, preserving it, rehabilitating it, restoring it, nothing. They just left it to rot for 20 years. And then in August of 1979, a citizen reported a car bomb outside of a strip club in downtown Nashville. The bomb was disarmed a mere 20 minutes before it was scheduled to detonate. It would have destroyed around 3 blocks of downtown Nashville, including the Ryman.
Damn.
Yeah. In September of 1983, the NLT Corporation was acquired in a hostile takeover by American General Insurance. The NLT Corporation, I guess, was the parent company of WSM because this is the very first time that they are mentioned at all. WSM, Opryland properties were absorbed by the Oklahoma-based Gaylord Broadcasting Company, which later moved its headquarters to Nashville and was renamed Gaylord Entertainment Company. And do we recognize Gaylord from anything?
Yes.
Gaylord Opryland Hotel and Convention Center. I am very drunk, actually. This is going to be really difficult. The company's chief executive, Ed Gaylord, became acquainted with many of the Opry stars during his involvement and was involved in the television series Hee Haw, which I am only hearing about for the first time.
What?
Yeah.
I used to watch that.
I'm a baby.
I used to watch that as a little kid. I mean, obviously reruns, but...
When were you a little kid?
In the 80s.
Mm-hmm. And they acquired it in 83, so you were a year old, well, almost a year old, and it was in September.
Yep.
So, and when was I born? A long time after that.
Shh.
Anyway, Gaylord Entertainment Company acquired it for $250 million in 1983.
Sheesh.
$649,599.64 in 2020 dollar.
Damn.
Anyway, it's assumed that he wanted to acquire the Grand Ole Opry because he wanted to rub elbows with the likes of Sarah Cannon and other celebrities. He had, what's the word, when you have aspirations. He also acquired Ryman Auditorium as an afterthought, although he didn't plan to demolish it because he appreciated the history. The 60th anniversary celebration in 1986 of the Grand Ole Opry aired on CBS as a special program that featured some of the Opry's legendary stars performing at the Ryman. While it was sitting dormant, major motion pictures continued to be filmed on location there. John Carpenter's Elvis, Coal Miner's Daughter, Sweet Dreams with the story of Patsy Cline, Clint Eastwood's Honky Tonk Man, a 1979 television special.
Wait, did you say Clint Eastwood?
That's what I said.
Well, I didn't know he sang anything.
It's a movie called The Honky Tonk Man. In 1982. It was the year you were born. So.
Yes.
Dolly Parton was featured on a television special of Dolly and Carol in performing a gospel medley on the Ryman stage. So it was sitting vacant, but it was still being used. Anyway, in 1989, Gaylord Entertainment began work on restoration of the Ryman's exterior. They improved it structurally, and they installed a new roof, you know, replaced broken windows, all that shit. It's actually really pretty. Like, all the windows are different colors, stained glass.
Kinda nice. Cute.
From April 30th, to May 2nd, 1991, Emmy Lou Harris and the Nash Ramblers performed three acoustic concerts at the dilapidated building, during which no one was allowed to sit on or beneath the balcony due to safety concerns. And the capacity was limited to around 200 out of, I think, 1,000. Some of the recordings were released as an album titled At the Ryman. So, in 93, they began renovations to restore it into a world-class concert hall. The auditorium's original wooden pews were removed, refurbished, and returned to the building to continue to serve as the auditorium seating. The far-reaching ends of the balcony were removed, and new backstage facilities were built inside the original building, while new structures containing a lobby, restrooms, concessions, and a grand staircase leading up to the balcony were constructed and attached to the east side of the auditorium.
Nice.
They moved the entrances and all, you know, boring stuff, blah, blah, blah. The first performance of the brand new and improved Got a Facial Ryman was a broadcast of Garrison Keillor's A Prairie Home Companion on June 4th, 1994.
We've seen that movie.
Have I?
Yes, we watched it.
When?
Remember?
No.
It's called Prairie Home Companion.
Yes.
With, what's his face? From Zombieland.
From Cheers.
From Cheers.
Woody Harrelson.
Woody Harrelson, yes.
No, I do not recall. Are you sure you watched it with
me?
Yes. Was it with your girlfriend?
No, it was with my boyfriend. Hmm. Was with you, ding dong.
Was I awake?
Yes.
Okay, well, I have a terrible memory because I don't remember.
Yes, you do.
On October 18th, 1998, the Opry held a benefit show at Ryman Auditorium, marking its return to the venue for the first time since its final show on March 15th, 1974. Why am I talking with a southern accent right now? The show was very popular, and they decided to host the opera's regular shows there on January 15th and 16th, 1999, as part of the celebration to commemorate 25 years at the new venue. So, to commemorate being at the new venue for 25 years, they had shows at the old venue?
I don't know.
Anyway. Beginning in November 1999, the opera was held at Ryman Auditorium for 3 months because of the success of the shows in January. Obviously, the new location wasn't doing so hot. I guess it's not new. It's from the 70s to the 90s. It's not exactly new. But anyhow, I mean, whatever. They were there almost as long in both locations. 31 years at the Ryman, 30 years at the whatever place. The Grand Ole Opry House. That's it. This is rough. You can edit some of this out, man. The construction of the Opry Mills Shopping Mall, which replaced the Opryland USA theme park in 2000, right next door to the Grand Ole Opry House. In January of 2012, plans were announced to replace the Ryman 61-year-old stage with one. Why is that important? With a new one. This is rough. In January of 2012, they announced plans to replace the Ryman 61-year-old stage with a brand new one. The new stage floor has 18 inches of the old floor as a lip on the front edge, similar to the way the Ryman stage had been inlaid into the Opry House stage.
Okay.
Does that make sense? Was that a grammatically correct sentence?
I don't know.
This is so bad.
So the old one was inlaid with the new one, or the new one was inlaid with the old one?
The new one has an 18-inch lip of the old... Okay, let's just restart that over. Can you just stop?
I got it.
Are you sure?
Yes.
In January 2012... plans were announced to replace the Ryman 61-year-old stage with a brand new Brazilian teak one. The new stage, which was the third in the facility's history, has an 18-inch lip of the old at its front edge. Kind of like how they cut out a circle of the old stage and inlaid it into the stage at the Opryland, the Grand Ole Opry House.
Yes.
In 2015, they did another $14 million worth of renovations and expansion. Gutted the 94 expansion, completely remodeled it. Yeah. So, I mean, Opry Entertainment Group still stages weekly shows at the Ryman year-round. In addition to the Opry at the Ryman shows in the winter, the auditorium hosts Opry Country Classics each spring and autumn. There's Bluegrass Nights at the Ryman and all kinds of stuff. So it's hopping. 125-year anniversary was in 2017, and they celebrated with Little Big Town. I don't know who that is.
It's a country music band.
Okay, cool. Anyway, they did a very brief residence performing 10 shows over the course of a year. So, did we survive that?
Yes.
Okay. Well. And now for the spooky shit. There is a legend of a curse on the Ryman Auditorium. There has been lots of paranormal activity, lots of reports throughout the years. The building, of course, has a long history, 120 plus, probably 130 years by now, of history. I'm not going to even try to count from when it was built to today, so don't at me. I don't want to do the math, and I'm not going to. The curse is a legend that was started around the 70s. There has been a lot of tragic deaths of country music stars throughout the years. Patsy Cline and Jim Reeves died in a plane crash.
Yes.
String Bean Aikman was murdered. Texas Ruby Fox and a car crash killed Ira Louvin.
Hank Williams Sr.
Had a heart attack on his way to perform a show.
I think so, yeah.
Something like that. It is rumored that there are over 35 victims of the Ryman Curse. There are a lot of spirits that are rumored to live in and around the Ryman. Again, very storied history. Probably the most, in my mind, the one that to me would probably be the most prominent ghost would be that of Thomas Ryman.
Yes.
The man who built the Ryman Auditorium, the Union Gospel Tabernacle. He is rumored to haunt the place because he built it as a house of worship. And then these sinners go and sully it with this ruckus and body entertainment. And, you know, can't have that. So, there's lots of stories of him being seen. He, at the end of his life, after he converted, he only wore gray from head to toe. And so, reports of a man in gray kind of throughout the building. Some people think that maybe it's a Confederate soldier. I think that if it's a man in gray, Thomas Ryman was known to wear gray. It's most likely to be him. But who knows? Hank Williams Sr. is often seen in the backstage area. Some people claim to see him as a white mist on stage. He's also been seen behind the auditorium. There's an alleyway behind the auditorium that leads to the Orchid Lounge, which was a favorite of Hank's. Anyway. Yeah, that's it. That's all the ghosts. That's all I have.
That's all the ghosts.
That's all it says! The man in gray and Thomas Ryman, which they are, in my opinion, the same person.
I thought that was more than that. Is that the article I sent you?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, that wasn't as long as I thought it was going to be, but also, I don't even know where I am or what day it is, so who knows?
Well, it's 11 o'clock. Friday night, and I get to work tomorrow.
I'm sorry.
That's fine. Anyway, so if hopefully everybody understood that story.
I didn't.
Kind of wonky, so.
I hope you can edit it so that it makes sense. If not, I can re-record when I'm sober.
That's fine. This is what people are looking for. So.
Drunk ramblings of a crazy person?
Yes.
Well, welcome, friends.
Yes. So, if anybody like that and wants any more information, they can, you know, look up...
Just Google Ryman Auditorium.
Ryman Auditorium.
Spoiler alert, I'm lazy, so Wikipedia was my only source. And then Paul sent me an article about the ghosts and shit.
Yeah.
And then there was a podcast that I listened to, which was mostly fake stories.
It's not fake stories. It's stories based on the hauntings and the history.
Fake stories.
Anyway.
Creative licensing was definitely
It's used. One of my favorite podcasts. Okay. Anyways.
Podcast mill. It's like BuzzFeed for podcasts.
You're paying the ass.
Yes, I am. And you like to be in pain, otherwise you wouldn't have married me.
Something like that.
Masochist.
Anyway, if you have any stories or requests of anything you want to hear about, or
yes,
if you know anyone who does, please email us. I know you won't.
Stop! Baby.
AfraidishPodcast@gmail.com, Instagram and Facebook @AfraidishPodcast, and Twitter @Afraid_ish, All links will be in the show notes.
Please email him so he'll stop crying about how nobody emails him.
Literally, nobody has emailed me.
Just keep it appropriate, people.
Anyway, well, okay. So, I got my first troll on Facebook. I posted, you know, some pics and stuff from the last episode. And this person from Tennessee says, "Not real." Which, obviously, you know, these hauntings and stuff, I'm not claiming are real. I'm not claiming they're not real. It's, you know.
It's, we're literally just sitting around here bullshitting about something that's entertaining or interesting or whatever.
I mean, if you want to believe, that's fine.
Okay, Fox. Mulder.
Anyways. So he goes, "Not real." And I go, "I know. It's an urban legend. I talk about history, hauntings, urban legends, and folklore." And I was trying to be nice, you know.
You fed the troll.
And he goes, "All fake stuff." I didn't reply.
History's fake, man.
It's like, if you want to pull the whole fake news shit, you know, I don't know. Just, anyway, we're not claiming it's true. These are just stories. This is a podcast. Seems to be mostly about history of these haunted places, which I like.
Me too.
Yeah, I mean,
you know,
if you don't like it, there are other podcasts.
Apparently, your mama was no good because she didn't teach you manners.
Anyways, if you don't like this podcast, just move on to a podcast you do like.
Why didn't you listen to the podcast?
Well, no, obviously not.
He literally, Paul, here's the thing. Trolls live under bridges.
Yes.
What is the internet? It's a bridge.
Yes. No, what happens is I put a bunch of hashtags, and I happen to put, like, Tennessee stuff and Nashville stuff. And
I get trolls on my Instagram account all the time. I literally just delete them. Or if I'm feeling salty, I'll leave them up, and I will respond in a professional and calm manner and prove to them why they're stupid and why I know more than them. Because usually they don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah. Anyways, what I'm trying to say is these aren't necessarily true. We like the history of these places, and
it's interesting.
Interesting stuff, and I like haunted places. I would love to visit and eventually go ghost hunting sometime.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
If anybody's interested,
at me. Could form a little ghost hunting brigade.
Yeah, we can get some equipment and
I got the Ghost Tube app on my phone. Don't ever use it in this house, though, please.
Anyways.
I want to know.
So, you know, at me, email me.
Don't at me. I ain't got time for your bullshit.
At me. I deal with all the social media and email.
I got too much shit to deal with.
Anyways, so I'm also hoping to get more extra content out. More video type stuff, which I haven't done yet. I'm hoping to do. And if anybody has any suggestions or want to hang out and talk about ghosts and haunted crap, you know, email me.
Message him on Instagram.
Yeah. And as always, don't be afraid of the dark.
Be afraid-ish of what's in it.
Bye.
Toodles.
See you next time.